Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. Now, friends, there are times that we talk about some really tough things on this show, and I have promised you from the beginning that we would do that. And these are things that we don't want to be in our world, that we don't want our kids to face, but they are realities of what we're facing, and we have to have the courage and the faith to face them head on and to really equip our kids to be able to respond to health threats that come their way. So before we dive in, I just want to give everyone a little tiny second to protect those younger, more vulnerable ears and make sure that your kids are in another room or that you put in your AirPods or your earphones or that you just listen to this podcast later, because today we are going to be talking about the very real threat of suicide. Now, this is a difficult topic for many, and so I just want to ease into this topic and make sure that you have time to settle your heart and your mind before we get started. Now, this is something that is a reality and something that impacted me very deeply at an early age. It was actually November of 1996. I was in nursing school and working at a pediatrician's office, and it was early in the morning. I was just going about my day, getting the exam rooms ready, looking at my schedule, getting ready to just give care to the families who came to the clinic that day, when I got a phone call that would change my life forever. One of my very best friends from church, who had actually been our youth ministry intern and had gone to a Christian college while I was at a different college, that she had died by suicide. And friends, when I tell you that I never saw it coming, I cannot emphasize enough the fact that I never saw it coming. I had no idea. I felt completely blindsided, completely just shattered. And I was really honestly feeling a little guilty, feeling like maybe if I was a better friend, would I have recognized that? Now, all throughout the rest of my life, I have had several tragic intersections with suicide, both personally and professionally, even among my children's peers. That has happened in a very personal, deep way, and responding to the aftermath of that is extremely difficult, and I don't think that I've seen a more painful kind of challenge that families have faced. In my profession, I see this every single day. I see kids who are thinking about suicide or who have attempted. Now, I work in primary care, and so we routinely screen for these thoughts, and every day I will have children who tell me, yes, I'm thinking about this. And parents, the scary reality is that it's happening younger and younger. We used to see older teens who were thinking about this, but now we see younger teens. And I think even back a couple of summers ago where I was at a camp serving as the camp nurse, and we had an 11-year-old who tried to take their own life. I mean, it is extremely tragic. My oldest daughter, when she was in high school, she did a science fair project and looked at media screen time, correlating that to suicidal thoughts and behaviors. And she was horrified to discover that right there among her own peers, 1 in 10 of those kids was thinking about suicide on a daily basis. Now, suicide is the second leading cause of death between the ages of 10 and 24. The number one cause of death is accidents. That's the only thing that kills more kids than suicide. But most alarmingly, since 2007, suicides among children have increased by up to 60%. One in five teens report suicidal thoughts or behaviors, and one in 40 are serious enough to need medical treatment. Now, many times that's where they would intersect with me. I worked at a community regional hospital where we would keep kids safe for a short period of time, make sure that they recovered from whatever their attempt was, and we would evaluate them to see, can they be treated outpatient or for their safety and for their best long-term well-being, do they need to go somewhere else? Now, even though we know that this is happening and we see the suicides happening, even more concerning, for every attempt, for every completed attempt, there are an estimated 100 to 200 survived experiences. Now, researchers can't agree on a single cause exactly why this is happening, but I think we all know that social media is playing a very big role on this, leading to detrimental mental health outcomes, and there are a myriad of other factors, but we do know that social media is definitely prominent among the mix. Now, although girls are more likely to attempt suicide, boys often use more fatal methods. Now, one of the reasons we want to talk about this today is because kids are impulsive. Their frontal cortex, that is responsible for executive decision making, it is not fully developed until their early 20s. And so kids often, they make a mistake. And if you listen to one of my previous shows where we talked about sexting and sextortion, where kids are extorted after they engage in what they believe is consensual sexting online, only to find out it is an extortionist, an abuser that is often even in another country that demands money, kids can't see a way out of that humiliation. And sometimes they're more afraid of living than they are of dying. And one study of survivors found that one in four who had attempted suicide, they deliberated and thought about it for less than 5 minutes before. Another quarter was 5 to 19 minutes. Another quarter was 20 minutes to an hour. And so we need to talk about this. It is something that parents are really afraid to talk about, but talking about it is not going to give kids ideas that were not there before. It's just absolutely not. It is perfectly okay to talk about it, and asking saves lives. Asking really saves lives. And so we're going to talk today about what to do. Now, I want to give you kind of a primer here of exactly what to do and an overview in these situations. And then we are going to invite on a guest, a fellow nurse practitioner, who is going to talk to us. We're going to have a conversation and discuss some of these things that we are seeing as pediatric healthcare professionals and how to equip parents. Now, when to worry. It is always an emergency if someone is saying that they have thoughts of suicide. As a parent, if your child tells you that, that is an emergency. You need to do something about it right away. Whether you call your primary healthcare provider or a mental health care provider, if you have a connection to one already, or if you don't know what else to do and you're just at a loss, then you go to the emergency room. Anytime you hear a child, your own child, or the friend of one of your children, or any child talking about harming others, or reporting they've experienced abuse, or saying that they're harming themselves, that's something that has to be taken care of right now. We need a safety plan in place right now. The things that are urgent are those things that are affecting quality of life. So if it is affecting what you are doing every single day, if it is, you know, affecting the way that your family is interacting, or the places that you can go, or the places you feel like you can't go, or school attendance, then those are things that you really need to get taken care of urgently, which means do something today. do something that you make a plan to handle it. And so those things are important. Now, if anyone ever discloses to you suicidal thoughts or behaviors, which a lot of times people will introduce these as a joke, kind of floating the idea just to see what the response will be, it's important to teach our kids to always stop the conversation right then. Just stop it and say, are you thinking about harming yourself? Are you thinking about killing yourself? And I know, parents, that can seem like such a difficult question to ask, and it's probably making some of you listening uncomfortable even in listening to that, but it is very important to ask that. And if they say, yes, I am, the question that follows should be, do you have a plan? And if they have a plan, friends, that is a life-threatening emergency, and you need help as soon as possible. If they don't have a plan, then that is an emergency. That is something that you want to take care of as soon as you possibly can, and know that this is urgent and you need to get connected to somebody today. Now, my guest today is Dr. Amy Moreno. She is my colleague. She is also a pediatric nurse practitioner, and she's faculty with me at Baylor, and she has a clinical background in the pediatric intensive care and in neurosciences and rehabilitation. She is a leader and has served as in many capacities as leader, and has been just extraordinarily supportive of mental health, and she's been a great supporter of children and trafficking, and has worked collaboratively with me on many of those things. But right now, she is serving at the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners on their as co-chair of their Alliance for Prevention of Youth Suicide, which is so exciting. And she is passionate about improving the identification of youth who are at risk for suicide and empowering healthcare professionals in all clinical settings to implement suicide screening practices. And we are going to have a conversation today about what is going on in the world, why is this such an issue, and what can we as parents do about it. Amy, welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show.
Thank you so much for having me here to talk with you guys about this today. I am very excited to talk about this.
I am too, and I can't wait to get later in our discussion where we discuss how faith informs all of this. So stay tuned, because you might think that this is really depressing and this is just hopeless, but there is hope to be found, and Amy and I will help you find it together. Amy, from your perspective, why do you think suicide rates among youth are soaring right now? What is going on from your view?
No, that's actually a really great question. You know, one of the things that has come out of COVID is that we've started talking about mental health more. You know, in 2011, teens that were hopeless or felt sad, the rates were much lower. There was 21% of boys that reported that and 36% of girls. And then you jump forward to 2021, whenever we're in the middle of this pandemic, and the rates significantly increased. So for boys, it went up about 8%, but for girls, it was a 50% increase. And so when you think about that, the rates increased, but we're also talking about it a lot more. So while it seems very scary and like a very terrifying conversation to have, we are learning how to talk about this. So while the problem seems really huge, this is something that we can do to prevent, you know, prevent crisis. There is something we can do with this.
And I think that's what parents want to hear, you know, that there is something that we can do, that there is hope on the other side, because so often when it occurs, it seems hopeless. And you and I both know that there is a big connection right now between the current mental health crisis and suicide, and that can be really difficult. And I think, you know, for a lot of times, it can even cause families to have a crisis in their faith, which I said that we're going to get to a little bit later. But, you You know, the interesting thing is that suicide is actually mentioned in the Bible. And there are seven recorded instances in the Bible. And as God's image bearers, we must be aware that Satan seeks to steal, kill, and destroy. He's the father of lies. He's a murderer. His native language is lies. And he can whispers convincing deceptions to destroy God's image in our kids, telling them that they're better off without us. Them. The world is better off without them, that no one cares, that they're all alone and there's no hope. But those are all lies. And we know that God's love surpasses our ability to even comprehend it. And nothing separates us from the love of God through Christ, even death. When we come back after this break, we're going to talk about seeking health care in these crises. Don't go away.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey, friends, and welcome back to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. As I told you in the first segment, we are talking about a pretty tough topic today. And so this is not the best conversation for little or more sensitive ears. We are talking about the crisis that is gripping our country and killing kids. We're talking about suicide. Now, I'm talking to Dr. Amy Moreno, who is my colleague at Baylor and currently the chair of the Alliance to Prevent Youth Suicide, which is an initiative of the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners. Now, before the break, Amy, we were talking about why are these soaring right now. So let's talk a little bit about the connection between mental health and suicide, and what does that look like to bridge the gap and go to healthcare? You know, in my seat, I think when parents come in, there are things that have been going on for quite a long time, but parents are just literally afraid to go to healthcare. They're afraid their kid's going to be taken away from them, committed, or forced onto medication or some things like that. What does that really look like? How can we help parents to feel empowered to navigate the healthcare system if their child is having suicidal thoughts?
That's a really great question, Jessica. I will tell you, as the parent of a child that has struggled with this, this was hard for me to navigate, even as a medical professional. And, you know, the statistics show that 15% of kids have experienced a major depressive episode in the last year, but 60% of them don't receive mental health treatment. So regardless of, you know, our ideas of what we think might happen or our preconceived notions of what people will think about us or our child, this is happening and children are dying from it. So while it's difficult to navigate, I will say as healthcare providers, we are getting much better at navigating it. And we are getting much better at creating pathways to respond to children who say that they're thinking about committing suicide or they're having suicidal thoughts. And just like you talked about earlier, it used to be this thought that if we ask the questions or if we talk about suicide, that it's going to instill a small thought into their head that maybe they didn't previously have, but the data actually doesn't support that at all. So honestly, the first thing that you can do is ask the questions, talk about it, use language that is not shameful. Talking about a person that is thinking about suicide versus a person that is suicidal or a person that committed suicide versus died by suicide. Really like kind of separating those thoughts from the person really allows you to talk about it as though it's something that we can normalize and something that we can do something about.
That's absolutely true. And so, Amy, walk parents through, what does that look like from the moment they walk into the door and say, oh my goodness, I think my kid might be having suicidal thoughts. What is going to happen from there? Let's explain that to everybody.
Sure. I think one of the hardest parts about that is that there are some subtleties in it that make it a little bit hard to know how to respond. If a child comes to you, any child, whether it's your child, your family member, another person's child, if a child says, I'm thinking about committing suicide, or I'm thinking about, you know, performing suicide, I'm thinking about this, or these thoughts are popping up into my head and I don't know why, because oftentimes that's what's happening. Like the thoughts are just coming up in their head. It's not like they're consciously choosing to have the thoughts. And so just like you talked about earlier, do you have a plan to do something about this? Have you thought about ways that you have done that you would do this in the past? Some of the nuances that make it hard, you know, sometimes they'll say something like, yes, I've thought about this previously. And so then you think, okay, is this an active emergency? But regardless, those thoughts are what needs to be addressed. Because just like you spoke about earlier, their brain development causes them to have make very impulsive decisions. And my experience as a parent, it was a very impulsive, very fast decision. And fortunately, it was not a successful attempt. And so we've had a lot of time to work on developing coping skills that create space between a thought and an action. And that's really what you're wanting to do, because the thoughts may come up. But the more therapy you get, the more coping mechanisms you develop, the more tools that they get in the toolbox, the more age that they get, the more time they'll put between a thought and an action. And I think it's really important to make sure if a child tells you, I've been having suicidal thoughts, that you don't give them any kind of shameful response. Because if we are causing some sort of shame to be associated with the thoughts, they're not going to talk about it. They're not going to tell us whenever they're having those thoughts. And so I do think it's very, very important for us to approach it in a calm manner and talk about it, internally, because I have been there, internally, all of your emotions are coming up and you are terrified for the child that's in front of you. I think trying to externally remain very calm and almost just in a very logistical manner. Okay, so have you thought about a plan? Okay, tell me more about that. How long have you done that? And then really just develop a plan. I'm going to call if they're currently having active suicidal thoughts, okay, well, we need to go to the emergency room and we need to talk to somebody about this so we can make sure that we're safe. Because in that moment, safety is everything if they're having suicidal thoughts in that moment and they have a plan. So I think it's very important just for us to approach this with an open mind. Remember that we are dealing with a child that is very scared. This is a very, this can produce some very shameful emotions around it, which makes it very hard to talk about it. But I do think the more we talk about it, the more we can normalize the conversations. And in that, I'm not saying normalize the thought processes, because we are terrified about these, about, you know, them performing this. But if we can normalize conversations around it, that can only open up opportunities for conversations so that we can ensure safety.
Absolutely. And you did such a great job, Amy, of outlining like what that looks like, even as you've shared in your own experience as a parent and making those kinds of decisions and thinking, okay, we need to go to the emergency room. And if it's not an emergency, if they say, no, I don't have a plan, but I just have these thoughts, that is a time where you need to seek a healthcare provider. And parents, this is where it's so important to already have an established relationship with a healthcare provider that you know and you trust. Because if you don't have that established care, and if you find yourself at the point of crisis, it's really hard to walk in and see somebody you don't know from Adam and just say, oh, hi, by the way, I'm here because of this and I need some help. But so it makes it easier, but it is not impossible to do in that situation. And I don't want that to be a barrier. So when you walk into that clinic, that's going to look like us, especially as nurse practitioners, we care about holistic health, looking at your physical health, but your emotional health, your mental health, your spiritual health. And we have some questionnaires that we can do that can help us advise you as a parent to say, okay, this is a very dire emergency. This is something we really need to be concerned about and do something about today. Or all the way to, you know, this is something that is looks like it's mild, looks like we're catching it early, and there are some really effective interventions that we can have. And most of the time, I think, Amy, parents need to know that even if there is a mental health condition that's contributing to this, like anxiety or like depression, medication is not the first treatment in most cases for those kinds of things, although it can be an effective tool as you're acquiring other things like cognitive behavioral therapy and counseling and spiritual support, and all of those things are really, really important. But if you're at that healthcare provider office and they say, okay, we are going to have a plan, whether that's through mental health care or whatever it may be, depending on the contributing factors, and you're going home with your child, just what you said, safety planning is so important. And not to be secretive or forceful about it, you know, to say like, oh, I'm going to do this. And, you know, as a kind of punitive or threatening thing, or like a secretive, like tiptoeing around it, having that open communication to say, while you're having these thoughts, we need to make sure, I want to make sure that our home is as safe as possible for you. And these are the things that we're going to do. Now, Amy, you and I know that actually almost 70% of suicides in young people happen by firearm. That's just the reality of the situation. And so that is an important part of safety planning and means reduction, which means that we just reduce their means available to them to try that suicide attempt. So what do you have to offer to parents about safety planning and means reduction? How can parents keep their kids safe at home?
No, that's really, the lethal means counseling is one of the big ways of suicide prevention. You know, the most lethal means for suicide attempts is firearms. Now, you know, I'm not here to talk about anything about whether people should have firearms or not. I think the conversation is more like, can we make sure that the firearms are safely put away so that we can provide an environment where this person, this child can work on some skills to have better coping mechanisms, and that we can create even a short delay between the impulse that you have, that they may have to have a suicide attempt, and access to means. Because even in that short delay, that can save lives. So the most lethal means, of course, that we talked about is firearms. But the most common means is medication, poison. So things like prescription and non-prescription medications, Tylenol, ibuprofen, you know, like I've seen them at Costco. I understand buying these medications in bulk. And unfortunately, like that also provides a large number of medication tablets that can be ingested in that short period of time. So making sure that we have medications locked up, any kind of cleaning agents or supplies, making sure that we can focus on the means that we can access restriction to or restrict access to. So firearms, medications, poisons. Those are the ones that we can really do the most about. And those would address the most lethal means and the most common means.
That's really reassuring to think about. And I think that, you know, when we talk about means, this is just kind of a normal point of curiosity for parents who may hear about another suicide in their community. And there is something called suicide contagion. And this means it happens in the community and other kids may be given thoughts or inspired to take their own lives. You know, the common misconception is that talking about it, you know, makes it more contagious somehow, but that's not the truth. And when we look at suicide contagion and the research that's there, actually, one of the biggest contributors to that is talking about the means. But usually when I hear a conversation about this, you know, when a child will share with an adult and say, oh my goodness, you know, so-and-so died by suicide, or however they're going to share that news with you. So many times, the first question that I hear out of people's mouths, or people that ask me, they say, oh my gosh, how did they do it? Like there's just some sort of morbid curiosity that's there. And I think that people are doing it as a coping mechanism. They're wanting to find out like, what was that? And then, oh, I would never do that. Like, oh, I don't have a gun in my house, or I would never take that medication, or, you know, that kind of thing. And it's a morbid curiosity, and that's not helpful to ask. So if you're listening and thinking, you know, what's one thing that I can do to help in the way that we talk about it, the first thing, one of the first things you can do is when you hear about that, express empathy first. Just say, I'm so sorry this happened. That is so tragic. That is so heartbreaking. How are you? Instead of focusing on that, because we're going to talk more about stigma, but you know, the, some kinds of messages that I hear are, you know, oh, I'm not surprised. I saw that coming a mile away. Or how did you not know? Are you sure there weren't any warning signs? Or why in the world would they do that? That's so selfish. Oh, I feel so bad for their mother. You know, those kinds of things. Instead of saying, I'm sorry, this must be unimaginably hard. How are you feeling? I'm here for you whenever you need me. Even something like, I don't know what to say, but I want you to know I'm sorry and I really care. Those kinds of things are really, really important. And I'm so glad, Amy, that you brought up medication. And in my book, Behind Closed Doors, A Guide for Parents and Teens to Navigate Through Life's Toughest Issues, one of the chapters is all about suicide. And the case that I shared there was a child who actually stole Benadryl or diphenhydramine off of the grocery store shelf when shopping with their parents, just like you talked about, an industrial size bottle like that, and went into the bathroom and took them. And, you know, this was a teenager. So when your toddler runs off, you kind of get paranoid after a couple of minutes. But a teenager, you have a lot more tolerance, I think, for them being gone for a while. And so after 20, 30 minutes, which is enough time for that medication to start to work, that teen was eventually found in the bathroom. Now, these are stories, again, Amy, that just rip our hearts out as parents and just grip our hearts with fear. But on the other side of this break that's coming up quick here, we're going to talk about stigma and how we can provide, how we can combat that to provide hope. Now, I want parents listening out there to know that there is a national hotline. Maybe you knew this, or maybe this is news to you. All of you know 911. That is the call for emergencies that you call if you're having any sort of crisis. But 988. That's 988 is the new number for the National Hotline for Suicide Prevention. And so it's great to have in your phone and to have it as a contact. You can give it to your kids, teach your teens to say, if anyone ever says anything about anything, just share that contact and say, hey, there's help available at any time in case you ever need it. You never know if that simple resource will share a life. Now, on the other side of this break, we're going to talk about stigma, prevention, and faith. Don't go away.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at afr.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, friends, to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. We are tackling a tough subject today, but we are doing it with faith and hope, and we are going to find light on the other side. We are talking about youth suicide, and I'm in the middle of a conversation with my colleague, Dr. Amy Moreno from Baylor, who is chair of the Alliance to Prevent Youth Suicide at the national level. Now, we've talked about some of the contributing factors to suicide, the connection between mental health, how you seek help, and what to do if this happens to you, if you encounter a situation where a child is at risk, and what how do you make your house safe and have resources available to you? What we're going to talk about in this last segment is about stigma. Now, I want to read to you actually something that I wrote in my book, Behind Closed Doors, about stigma, because this is something that I see a lot. And honestly, especially in Christian communities, where when we struggle with something, many times we may feel guilty, feeling like our faith isn't strong enough and we are hesitant to reach out for help. But let's talk a little bit about stigma before I ask Amy some more questions about this. The dictionary actually defines stigma as a mark of disgrace associated with a particular circumstance, quality, or person. Now, if you didn't follow that, you're not alone. That's still a little cerebral. And I think about it this way. Stigma is an unhealthy coping mechanism used to deal with our fear that something bad will happen to us or someone we love. Stigma at its core is simply social rejection. Now, when we hear the unthinkable has happened, when we hear about suicide, if we're honest, our minds immediately start an internal ticker tape. We think alcoholic, mental illness, abuse, debt, divorce. Our brain clicks to a stop when we find that one thing that we see is completely different from us. And we get relief with self-adopted comfort that, oh, that's what's different. So that's the barrier. I'm going to reject that and it's never going to happen to me. And then what we do is we share that observation, and that's how we do it, saying, oh, well, you know, but they had a problem with drugs, or they had this, or they had that. And somehow we're trying to reassure our children or whoever we're talking to and ourselves that, hey, this could not happen to our family. But this psychological shift is critical. That moment of social rejection births stigma, and it places someone in a different imaginary category simply based on a characteristic we see as undesirable and threatening to our construct of security. Now, kids are listening to the way that we're talking about this. And one of the things that Amy, Dr. Moreno here, is very knowledgeable about is the neuroscience that impacts our brain when we have mental health struggles and when we have suicidal thoughts. So, Amy, how does that play into how our bodies work and how we kind of treat our lungs differently than we do our brains?
Yeah, this is something that I have encountered quite a bit. I am Christian and attending church with my child when things were, when we were struggling with mental health issues. So many times we were told that this was a matter of faith. And my daughter, that was, while I believe that God certainly gives us these tools, just like if we were, if we had diabetes or if we had some sort of infection, we would seek out, professional help. We would seek out someone to help advise us on what medications we need to take. Sometimes I've experienced a belief system that doesn't necessarily align to the idea that these mental health conditions fall under a medical condition. And so they can associate, just like you talked about, they can associate a stigma with them that makes it very hard to then ask for help. This is something that I see that oftentimes people will treat differently. But in fact, like just like God gave us tools to heal from infection by using antibiotics or have normal blood sugar levels by injecting insulin, there's also neurophysiology that supports the brain changes that are associated with mental health conditions. And I'm so grateful that he's also given us the tools to help with that too. So our children and even us as adults, we can live normal functional lives with the help of medicine that God's given us.
Yeah, whether that's in the form of counseling or therapy or actual prescription medication that may be a really helpful tool for that time. Now, parents can often feel guilty, right, when their kids voice suicidal thoughts or act out on suicidal behaviors, and they feel like, what did I do wrong? You know, what is wrong with me as a parent, or why is my child experiencing this? And just like you talked about, be afraid to reach out for help. How can we give those parents reassurance and hope?
Yeah, I remember having a similar conversation about why did I have a conversation? Why did I even have to talk about those things with my child? Feeling like I was to blame because I didn't see something or because I said something. And the truth of it is, I was being a parent and I was addressing something that needed to be addressed in the moment. And for me, I realized that if that was all that it took for my child to take an action that, you know, would result in something like that, then my child needed help. Because even if it didn't happen at my house, my child attends schools, is around peers, had a social media account, is involved with activities, there was going to be another action that occurred. So I think me realizing that while I was not, that, you know, while I felt responsible in some form or fashion, really, I was grateful for having a very clear picture of where my child was at in the moment when they talked to me about the thoughts they were having. And I kind of just had to set myself aside and be like, no, this is just how they're going to tell me about it. This is just what's going to get us to the point where we can talk about it. And honestly, it really opened my eyes to just be able to have open, frank dialogue about it. That is something that we even still do now is I don't associate it. It's been a lot of practice because, you know, it was a terrifying moment, but I don't associate shame or judgment with it anymore. We just have open, frank conversations. And, you know, like they're just like you talked about, you know, my child has a ton of tools in the toolbox now, in the arsenal to deal with thoughts that may come up that might be unhealthy. And when those thoughts come up, I can say, are we using the tools? Are you using the tools that you've been taught in your therapy program? Are you utilizing those things? And so we do have open dialogue about it now. And I just think it's really important as parents to try to really be careful about our words, be mindful of not really trying to figure out why, why they're at where they're at, or if you hear of a child that's died by suicide or an adult that's died by suicide, just like you talked about earlier, the why is really not important in that moment. It's dealing with the moment that is the most important thing.
Well, Amy, one of the words that you just said that caught my attention the most is anymore. I think that was kind of buried, and I want to go back and visit that because you said, I don't do that anymore, which means you did at first. And it's a common struggle for parents. You said that you associated it with shame or stigma or fear or those kinds of things, and you don't anymore. How has your faith informed the hope that you have? Because I know that you have a very strong faith and that has been one of the most essential things to get you through this. But what has your faith journey been like as a mom facing this and then using that experience to leverage your professional skill set to help other moms and dads who are facing the same thing?
So certainly whenever all of this came to light, I did a lot of wondering how I missed this, wondering how, you know, I was very close to my child, but wondering how I just failed to see those things. I looked a lot at myself, and I will tell you that as we've gone through this journey, I realized that while I contributed maybe to some of the things that were occurring in our home, like I wasn't in charge of any of that. And the truth of it is, my child has, you know, has been given to me by God as a gift. But they have their own journey, and they have their own story to tell, and they have their own pathway that they're going to follow. And so I learned that my child was going to have their own struggles. And I'm so grateful to be in the position that I could offer all of the tools. I could, you know, connect as much as I can, even though I will tell you, it is challenging even on this side to navigate the mental health system. It's challenging, but I will say that I've learned a lot about like what really leaning into God was. Like I, even before this, I was like, I'm a Christian. I walk by faith. I believe in God. I know that He's in charge of my life, but certainly this was like a development of faith that I just never knew before. And this was definitely not knowing the outcomes, knowing I had no control of what was going to happen, but knowing that it was, you know, I was just working in God's plan. And so, I mean, it has been an evolution of things even now. You know, we have a lot of conversation about, you know, like, how are you feeling? What are you thinking? But those are separate from me. Those are not my thoughts. That's not my struggle. And, you know, I've given my child all the tools that they can have. And I'm observing. Of course, I'm doing what, a responsible parent does. I'm observing. And when there are inconsistencies between behavior and words, I'm here to notice. But I also know that God's got complete control over this situation. And my child's life is my child's life. And my life is my life. And I'm just here to be a support. And God did not promise that things would be easy. He did not. He promised that we would not be alone. And so I just really, I've learned to cling to that. Like I've also learned to think of mental health and mental health struggles, which includes suicidal thoughts, as like, this is a chronic illness and we are going to have ups and we are going to have downs. And if I can move a little bit more in the ups and downs rather than reacting out of fear every time we have a change, then, that I just can learn to just kind of go with the flow a little bit more. Am I still, you know, do I still have the fear in my stomach that what if something happens and, I didn't notice. Yeah, it could happen. It could happen. But like, we can't live like that. And so I love my kid and I'm paying attention. But I'm also recognizing that we can move in this and we can have our ups and downs and God's in control. And He's going to give me the tools exactly when I need them. That has been my experience in this entire journey. Anytime that I have not known what to do, I've said a little bit, I've leaned more into His word until I had clarification and clear answers. And He shows up every time.
Well, Amy, I've seen you be so brave and do so many brave things. You are a mom of five, I should mention. You homeschooled. I think that's so brave, and I love that. And you've walked alongside your child in a journey with such love and care and a voice of advocacy. We just have about a minute left, but what words of advice would you give to parents who are wanting to advocate for their child along this journey and seeking help?
If your child has come to you and talked about thoughts of suicide, I mean, that is just the biggest obstacle that they can overcome, in and of itself. So praise them for that, love them for that. And then just be tenacious. It is a journey. It is a journey and it can be difficult to navigate. But, certainly if you are unclear about how to take the next steps, lean into the Lord, because know that He is going to show up with the answers. And if there is an actual concern, a true medical emergency, the 988 hotline is there for you, or the nearest emergency room, just to ensure safety for your child, because even those things can prevent suicide.
Amy, thank you so much for your courage and bravery in sharing with us today. Remember that nothing, absolutely nothing, separates us from the love of God through Christ, even death. And there is hope on the other side. I'll be posting some resources for you. And this is just a last minute reminder in finding hope in the world. There is hope to be found through Operation Christmas Child and sending a gift to someone. Go to SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.